If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, here we go. Here we go. Hour number two of this live broadcast here, TNT Today's News Talk. Patrick Henningsen, you're with us. Glad to have you with us here on Monday. No shortage of action over the weekend. World War III pretty much began or almost broke out, sort of did broke out. Depends on where you think we are on the escalation ladder. That's what we're talking about today. So we've been bringing on some of the more, cogent experts on this. Tony Gosling, of course, being one of them. He's been living and breathing and sleeping this subject for a very, very long time. So obviously he's somebody we want to be talking to right now to look at all the various angles of this. But over in the U.S., unfortunately, the conversation is a little bit more, let's say, grade school level. If you tune in to, especially, I mean, I'm going to pick on the conservative media because when it comes to foreign policy, I find the conservative media in the right-wing media in America to be pretty much vacant, totally out to lunch, and rarely, if at all, tethered to reality. And this is no different here on Monday. So if you survey the punditry or the so-called experts, foreign policy experts, John Bolton is all over the news, of course, screaming and breathing fire, saying Israel needs to attack, we need to escalate, we need more war. So the hawks are all out. And the talking point is Biden's weak. Trump was even selling this one, which is Biden's to blame for the Iranian attack on Israel because of Biden's weakness. It emboldened the mullahs in Iran to attack the Israelis. No, they didn't. The reason the mullahs decided to attack Israel is because Israel blew up an Iranian embassy in Damascus. Not to mention the genocide that's happened over the last 6 months. I mean, have we forgotten about that? You got to kind of remind that to the right wingers in America, of course. I mean, I'm often called a conservative. I mean, I don't wear my party membership card on my lapel like some people do. But people who follow my politics over the last 10 years or whatever, you sort of know where I'm at based on who I'm supporting and who I'm attacking and which policies I'm championing, which ones I'm not. I will say that the current Democrat-Republican structure right now does not cater towards common sense foreign policy. So I'm opposing the two-party duopoly at the moment and looking for a candidate that represents the views of the American people. Is that too much to ask? And I'm confused as to where Donald Trump is on foreign policy. He doesn't have much to say other than this would never have happened if I was president. Well, excuse me very much. Okay, but the full-throated support of Israel is the reason we're in this mess to begin with. They've been given the green light for everything. Donald Trump gave them the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, basically broke every international UN resolution, law, and treaty, all to placate the needs of an extremist ideological settler colony in the Middle East known as Israel. That's what Donald Trump's done. So he set the stage for Joe Biden, who gave Israel everything they wanted, okay? It's not Biden's weakness, okay? Biden has delivered every single JDAM bomb, every single piece of ammunition, every single satellite has been commandeered in the service of the Israelis as they massacre the civilian population of Gaza, okay? All with the help of the U.S. It would have been impossible without the 110% support of Joe Biden. Okay, to his fault, he has given everything that Israel had asked for. And the toll in terms of human lives, in terms of people disfigured, people who've lost limbs, the injured is excess of 60,000, 35,000 known dead, 15,000 children, 9,000 women, that's known dead. They estimate there's potentially another 5,000 missing under the rubble, and they reckon it's going to take somewhere between 10 and 30 years to clear the rubble. 10 and 30 years to clear the rubble. Okay, I've been to war zones before. I've been to cities where they're still cleaning up the war 30 years later. Okay, that's the reality. Okay, so it's not Biden's weakness. Quite the opposite. It's Biden's complete unflagging support of a genocidal regime in Israel. That's the problem, and that's where Trump has got it wrong. Of course, really has got it wrong. And so I asked the question on Twitter today. It's a fair question, that if Donald Trump wins in November, like all the polls suggest that he might, who is going to be advising Donald Trump on Iran and Russia? Are we going to have an intelligent, scholarly, and considerate expert or experts advising the president? Or are we going to have some unhinged ideologues and neocon charlatans like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton? Is that who's going to be advising the president? Because if it is, they're going to put this country and the world onto the path of World War III. Pure and simple. If you can't find anybody qualified with, I mean, put an EEG reader on the head, check for electrical activity, see if there's any brainwaves there. First, check to see if there's any brain activity. Then check their resume. And it's very rare you can get both of those things going right these days in Washington, because Trump's last team on foreign policy, he didn't start any new wars, but he didn't really stop any either. And he nearly started a war with Iran by assassinating Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandas. Okay. And that's something that the Iranians are never going to forget. And they might even take an opportunity to exact revenge for that unsolicited, targeted killing. And by the way, Soleimani was fighting ISIS and winning. Is that why the U.S. killed him? That was set up by the Israelis. And then at the last minute, the Israelis backed out and left the United States literally with the kill shot. And of course, they were there. They said, well, let's just go through with it. So isn't that interesting how Tel Aviv goaded the Trump administration to doing something that's totally not in their self-interest, not in the national interest of the United States, doing a favor, a solid for Israel, that Israel was supposed to carry out the final move and then peeled off right before the end and left the U.S. holding the can, our greatest friend and ally, Israel. You see how the relationship works. We do everything for them. They do very little, if anything, for us. We share all of our intelligence with them. They share nothing with us. That's the relationship. It's not exactly a two-way relationship. It's more like a parasitic relationship. That's the story, unfortunately, of this tail that's wagging the dog. We're going to take a short break right now with the network. And when we come back, we're going to connect our guest, Jay Dyer, author of Esoteric Hollywood 1 and 2, and much, much more. We're going to talk about end times, eschatology, cult, the red heifer, John Hagee. We're going to touch all of that because it's oh so relevant right now, today. All this and more on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen. We'll be right back.
TNT's Dirk Pohlman.
There was a plan on the British side to immediately after the victory over Germany to continue the war, to push the weakened Soviet Union back over over backwards. Yeah, so that is something that is not well known. That plan has been, you could find it on the internet and then it's off and on sometimes again. It's very difficult. It's not long. It's something like, if I recall correctly, something of 30 pages, I would say. I read it.
The Soviets had this coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948. And that appeared as the Soviets really was pushing forward, and they thought that this means that we have to start an alliance against the Soviets. And that was NATO became.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Ladies and gentlemen,
today's news talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. Thank you for joining us. We're now number 2 of this live broadcast. Oh, how time flies when you're having good fun here on the airwaves with you, our listeners, our viewers here on TNT. See everybody in the TNT chat room. Hello, you guys. I hope you're doing good there. Great to see the activity, the banter, the memes. That's where the action is, folks. If you're watching this, go to TNT Radio app, which you can get on either Google Play or on the App Store, and you'll see the chat option, which is down at the bottom of the menu, or go to tntradio.live, lower right-hand corner, red bubble. Get in there. That's where you want to be during the live show. Now, we had a great segment, of course, talking about the realpolitik of the Iran-Israel situation. I want to extend that story a little bit, though, with our next guest. He is a researcher, a presenter, a comedian, also a very successful author to boot, among other things. His name is Jay Dyer. He's the author of Esoteric Hollywood 1 and 2. Jay, appreciate you coming on the program this week.
Absolutely, Patrick. We always have really good conversations, so I'm glad to be here. And I always like breaking down weird versions of, you know, religious fanaticism, cults, and so forth. So happy to do that.
Yeah, and the timing right now, Jay, I mean, we definitely want to get your input on, we're talking about cults, end times, eschatology, religious extremism, crazed ideologues. There's plenty of them that are literally wringing their hands right now on Monday after what's happened over the weekend. They're anticipating that this is it. This is the final battle that's coming. The Christian Zionists, the pastors were just going off on Sunday. If you watched these sort of evangelical cable channels, you would have seen some of them. We've got a few clips. I'll share one of them with you, of course, in a moment. But it all seems to be coming to a head. According to some people, Jay, that this is the great battle. The great battle is about to come, and all this eschatological conclusions will finally reach the climax that everybody seems to have been living for, hoping for. Armageddon. I don't know. What do you make of this? How's your reading on this? I know you personally, what are your thoughts? And then, like, tell us what the playing field looks like on this.
Well, personally, my thoughts are I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to it because I remember growing up as a Baptist, hearing about red heifer stories, at least since the 80s and 90s. So this is a thing that's often recycled, especially, as you pointed out, in the sort of evangelical media sphere. They love this. They go crazy. I shared a meme of Nicolas Cage going wild on coke from the 80s in an interview. And I said, this is what you get when evangelicals hear, catch wind of the slightest story about the red heifer, because they believe that this is somehow sort of initiating the end of the world and that it has to happen and that that will trigger the Antichrist. And I'm not saying that, you know, whenever the end of the world is, that stuff won't happen in that way or whatever. I don't think we really know how it's going to shake out. But I can say beyond my own personal views of it that as I started studying this in my 20s and as I got older, I started noticing a lot more geopolitical tie-ins to a lot of the dispensational, evangelical, Christian Zionist end time stuff that when I was younger, I was very naive to. And as you get into think tanks and things like, you know, say John Hagee's connection to AIPAC and other entities, it started becoming evident to me that maybe there's other motivations to, you know, what people like John Hagee push. And I have to admit that when I was kind of an idiot, 18, 19-year-old evangelical, I actually bought the John Hagee study Bible at one time. I thought that this was like a great study Bible. And I thought, oh, yeah, the rapture and all this. But what I didn't know was the history behind the emergence of dispensationalism. This comes out of late 1800s British imperial, actually, I argue, cult theology, you could say, because John Nelson Darby was a member of the Plymouth Brethren, which was an offshoot of Anglicanism. So it was already kind of an imperial thing. And what Darby came up with was this idea that there's these arbitrary sort of divided series of history that don't really overlap with one another. And so rather than the older, longtime Christian teaching of both the Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, and most Protestant churches even, that the church is really the spiritual new Israel, the idea became, no, there's actually a dual covenant where God has a relationship to the church and to the followers of Jesus, but there's also still this validity to the Mosaic covenant by which Jews can still be saved outside of Christianity or through some other means. And so what again begins as what you might think is a religious ideology, I believe is actually promoted by the British Empire. This is right before we have the Balfour Declaration. This is right before we get the establishment of the nation state of Israel. And I think that the entities that were pushing this, particularly through what's called the Scofield Study Bible, that's printed, I think, Stephen, still to this day by Oxford University Press. It's not accidental that that was pushed massively in the United States at that time, where you have around the time of the post-Rather Great Awakening, so you get this period in American evangelicalism of revivalism and tent revivals, very popular all over the U.S., and this infusion of this new idea of dispensationalism, the coming rapture, the end times, Jesus is going to come back to Jerusalem, set up a new 1,000-year kingdom on earth, et cetera, that infused the American Protestant evangelical psyche, which again began as like part of, you know, congregational Baptist type church. This actually ends up spreading, I think, throughout the Protestant mind as a whole in America, and maybe even into the Catholic mind as well in America, because we sort of have this default to just assuming that all of these verses, all of this stuff is talking about the modern nation state of Israel, which I don't think a lot of this is referring to that. But that became the default through this, what you could argue is perhaps a geopolitical psyop of the pushing of the Scofield Study Bible, which to this day is still very popular amongst evangelicals. And that's why we have people like John Hagee and his Cornerstone Church, which, if you don't remember, a few years ago, I think it's around 2007 or 8, he actually put out a book saying that Jesus wasn't the Messiah. And it was such a controversy, he retracted that. So that's really what this is about, is sort of a geopolitical agenda to castigate and to sort of spin that Russia is Gog and Magog and China is in there somewhere. And somehow, oh, Iran is part of this antichrist end times religion thing. I don't agree with, you know, Shia Islam and their theology. I have a professor friend from Harvard, Dr. Khalil, who is a Shia Muslim. So I want to understand those positions, but I don't think that that has anything to do with what's going on in the Book of Revelation or something like that.
Yeah, the British imperial angle is very interesting, Jay, when you took it the geopolitical scope, because going back to previous empires like the Holy Roman Empire and the Crusades, trying to achieve not much different really than what the British were trying to achieve through their imperial machinations. So you can see how it's very important in the schism between Eastern Orthodoxy and Catholicism in the West, and all of these is managing the global imperium and the role that religion plays in that, and certainly end times dispensationalism, end time narratives, eschatology. I've got a clip here from John Hagee, as you brought him up. He is riding high right now in the evangelical world based on what's happened over the weekend. Let's roll this clip. I want to get your reactions and comments on this, Jay. Go ahead.
What exactly did you see last night that you want to share with the people this morning?
Prophetically, we are on the verge of the Gog-Magog war that Ezekiel described in chapters 38 and 39. This attack by Iran, who launched more than 200 missiles yesterday, is a tribute to the weak and pathetic leadership of Joe Biden. I assure you, if Ronald Reagan was president, we wouldn't be in this mess. Iran attacked Israel one day after our president looked into the face of the camera and said, "Don't." Don't you know they just laid on the ground and trembled with fear? They were loading the launch pad right then. The Democrats are trying to advise Israel to de-escalate, which is music to the ears of Hamas and Iran. We don't need to de-escalate. Hamas started a war murdering Jewish people. Hamas needs to be wiped out, period. So you heard me say, love is not what you do. Love is not what you say, it's what you do. So what are we going to do about it? You know, the providential timing of God is an awesome thing.
Well, he goes on and on, Jay, as you can imagine. What did you make of that? Gog and Magog, right? Opening gambit right there.
Exactly, right. Yeah, that's been a favorite of the evangelical end times preachers since probably before I was born, I'm sure. If it's conveniently into, geopolitical narratives as the need dictates. And, he made much ado about these supposed blood moons a few years ago. It looks to me like he's more interested in moon pies than blood moons. But when it comes to John Hagee, nobody pays attention to the failed predictions. And this is another thing that we see with a lot of these characters beyond the geopolitical, maybe even just more down to earth, is just sort of the classic con man agenda, where we constantly sort of tease an end times scenario. The Harold Camping style, where we predict the end when it doesn't happen. We sort of move the goalposts back a little bit. So, he made a big deal about the blood moons of Israel or something a while back. That wasn't anything. And this is just, part and parcel for, I think, people who are, they work for foreign powers. Very, very obvious now. I think people can figure that out. So it's sad because it really has nothing to do with traditional Christian theology whatsoever. But it's, again, very useful in a sort of geopolitical way, as end times narratives have always been. In fact, if you study cults, many of them capitalize on the imminent end times fear, panic, sensationalism. Throughout, you can go back to, for example, the Munzer Rebellion. I think they had an end times scenario going that, when the state, for example, I think the German state persecuted the Munzer Rebellion, and they say, "Oh, it's the end of the world," right? So, anytime there's a cult with the need to induce in the flock fear, anxiety, manipulation, we see this with, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses. I was just doing another deep dive on them recently. And they had a famous figure after Charles Taze Russell. His name was Judge Rutherford. And he did a very similar move where he said that the Messiah was coming back to San Diego, interestingly. And he told his followers, amongst Jehovah's Witnesses, to sell their possessions and prepare for a place for David and Jesus to live. And it ended up being a pretty nice size pad in San Diego that would probably sell for about $10 million. And when Jesus and Moses and David didn't show up, of course, Judge Rutherford ended up living there. Hal Lindsey did a very similar move where he predicted the rapture, I think, in 1988. And if I remember, I think he bought a bunch of Malibu property when the rapture didn't happen in 1988. So there's a con man level to this. But again, as you pointed out, there's also this whipping up the fervor of the mindless evangelical audiences that will think that this is somehow initiating the end of the world.
Well, so in Israel right now, one of the dominating political movements, part of the current prime minister's coalition, so the far right ethno-nationalist hardcore Ben-Gavir, Smolchurch, then you have these sort of radical settlers. They're now in cabinet positions now in Israel. So many will argue this is the most radical government ever in the history of the modern state of Israel in its infancy, whatever, 80 years now, I guess it's been going. And so according to the Temple Mount organization, this is a type of religious NGO, I guess, in Israel, that they asked for planning permission or a license to slaughter the red heifer on the Olive Mount within a direct line of sight to Al-Quds, as the Palestinians call it, Al-Aqsa Mosque, or the Temple Mount, as the Jewish residents refer to it. That's one of the sort of things that triggered off a round of hostilities called the Second Intifada, with Ariel Sharon going on to the Temple Mount, and that sort of sparked a religious conflict and another round of hostilities that many will argue we're at the end of right now. So, and what is the story with this red heifer? My understanding is that the prophecy is that they'll find this perfect red cow, and then they have to sacrifice it, I guess, to atone for worshiping the golden calf, the thing that Moses basically disapproved of when he came.
Well, I think that when the temple's gone, there can't be animal sacrifices, or at least the old Levitical structure. It requires the temple, and it requires the Aaronic priesthood. So there's a lot of these requirements, which I'm assuming that some of the people from this institute believe that they've met. Perhaps they've done genetic testing to figure out who the Kohanim are, which would be the descendants of the Aaronic priesthood. I don't understand the logic of how they would be able to do it without the temple. Maybe they think that this would initiate the possibility of building the temple, but the mosque is in the way. So perhaps this is a situation to agitprop, like a sort of a large style agitprop might also be what this is intended to do. I don't know. That might be. You referenced a previous event that sort of sparked Islamic reaction. So it might be for that purpose. But the interesting thing is that, of course, in Talmudic traditions, it's not exactly what's in the Bible. So the Talmudic traditions sort of they trump what is in the written texts of the Torah. So maybe they have reasoning as to how they can do this without a temple, or they believe that this will initiate that this would purify the area for the new temple that they would like to build. It might be all those things, but to me, it seems odd. I mean, I would think there has to be a temple before this works, but I think it's just part of the dedication of the temple and the ability to have the Day of Atonement and all of that, the way it's supposed to be practiced according to their tradition. So, but my guess would be there might also be, as you said or implied, kind of a agitprop psychological operation going on here.
Yeah, it would be considered a major provocation, definitely.
Right, exactly.
To especially for Palestinians and Muslims living there, even Christians as well. Building a third temple on the Temple Mount, the construction of the third temple, this would be the sort of moment where I don't know, is that when Israel supposedly comes into its own? Certainly the Christian Zionists look at this moment as really important, some kind of a harbinger for the coming of the Messiah. I'm not sure if I've got all that right.
Well, the coming of the Antichrist. I mean, I think most evangelicals believe that the next temple that would be erected would be for the Antichrist, and that would kick off, the events of Armageddon or the apocalypse. Which would lead to a world government, a world religion, and so forth under Antichrist. And then you would have the end of that after a period of time with the return of Christ. So in the evangelical mind, it signifies that. I would say that it also could signify that to Orthodox and Catholic theologians as well, who, although they don't share the same dispensational ideas of evangelicals, there is a pretty common consensus amongst Orthodox and Catholic church fathers, historians, theologians, that there would eventually be some final temple that would be dedicated to Antichrist. Whether this is that, I have no idea. Of course, we don't even have a temple yet. But if that's where this is going, it would be interpreted by a large portion of the Christian world in general as that.
Well, that's one of the strange things about this end times on the kind of Christian Zionist side, because, and I had this conversation with Christian Zionists and saying, what are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to do with all of these Jewish people in the Holy Land? What's the plan? They said, well, they're going to have to convert. They're going to have to convert. So, it's like the Jewish lobby, the Israeli lobby, definitely relies on Christian Zionists to bolster their political power and financial power in the U.S. And that helps Israel. But at the same time, the Christian Zionists are kind of using the Jews in the Holy Land as a sort of means to an end to get to their final story. So both sides are kind of using each other in a way. It's a very strange dance, Jay.
Yeah, the evangelical, exactly. The evangelical Zionist position believes that when these events are sort of kicked off, like, dominoes or something, that this will lead to a mass conversion of the Jews. They then believe that the Jews would then convert a large portion of humanity in this end time scenario. So if this is that from their perspective, right, if they begin to see a temple being constructed, if they begin to see, movement in that direction, the evangelical Zionists will believe that it is the final 7 years, the end of the world or whatever, the Armageddon period. And they will believe that the Jews are going to convert en masse and so forth. So it's a little more amorphous and ambiguous in the other Christian churches and traditions as to what exactly would be this sequence, because they tend to interpret a lot of these events in a more allegorical and spiritual way and not in such a literal way in terms of the book of Revelation. So, yeah, it's hard to know exactly what the reaction will be amongst a lot of those groups. But one thing that's ironic is I remember some years ago there was a video going around that they were interviewing a lot of Israelis and a lot of their perspectives on Christian Zionists, and they were all making fun of them, calling them complete retards. So the Israeli perspective of the Zionists is that they're idiots. They're Christian Zionists, right? So they don't have any respect or appreciation or the love is not mutual, right? They're essentially just useful idiots, perhaps. And I think that, yeah, in many ways, this is a bizarre delusion that's, born out of the fanaticism of the peculiarities of American Protestantism, Puritanism, evangelicalism, which sort of wants and grasps for maybe it's a way to see a confirmation for their beliefs and for their system, that if there is these signs and these events, then this must be the end of days, and it must then confirm, whatever the peculiar position is.
Yeah, that's that sort of self-fulfilling circular tautology. I mean, you talk about this with cults. That's one of the key things, isn't it? If you have a kind of a cult movement or an organization, you need these types of beliefs in place in order to hold the group together, to keep the group think together. And so would you say that it is possible to describe some of the aspects of, I mean, is it going to be controversial for some Christians and Pentecostal people, whatever, but some aspects of Christian Zionism are slightly cultish? Is that a stretch to say this?
No, not at all. Absolutely. I mean, I would say that, again, the way that, say, an Orthodox or a Roman Catholic person perceives the church to be the spiritual Israel, the evangelical Zionist doesn't really see the church or a church or historical church as that relevant. That is all sort of transferred to the nation state of Israel, or what's going on over in, since post 1948 or whatever. So they see that as kind of their church. That's essentially where all of their, their prayer, their focus is all, based on whatever's going down in the Middle East on a day-to-day perspective. So no, I think that's completely cult-like. Not that everyone in those groups is a cult leader or necessarily willingly involved in this, but I think that they're incorrect.
So that's
it does operate very cult-like in many sectors, for sure.
So what you're saying there, Jay, in the difference of the interpretation of what is the church or what is Zion or what is Israel, there's one that's a very materialistic interpretation of that, a thing, a plot of land, a temple, and there's another way of interpreting it that's more of a concept, an idea, a spiritual destination, if you will. Is that a good way to sort of describe those two, that schism?
Absolutely. I think all throughout the New Testament in particular, and then into the early days of Christianity, there was already a temptation towards what's called Judaizing, which is the idea that Christianity needs to go back to or import more and more of the Judaic elements rather than Christianity being its own thing with a proper sort of Old Testament framework, but that also that it needs perhaps circumcision, that it needs the Jewish feast days and all this sort of stuff, which the early church in the first 3-4 centuries already dealt with this. In fact, you see it in the book of Acts in chapter 15. There's already a question of what's the relationship between Christianity, the new emerging church, and Jews and Gentiles. And this issue was already solved in Acts 15. And the decision was that Gentiles do not need to become Jews to be Christians. And so much of the New Testament literature, whether it's Paul's letters to the Galatians, Romans, the book of Hebrews, they're all dealing with these issues. And they were all settled a long time ago. And that's why you don't really have anything like dispensationalism until it becomes geopolitically useful in the late 1800s, early 1900s to the British Empire. So that's really what is the key, I think, to unlocking a lot of this is just understanding its usefulness. And as you pointed out, the patterns that we see with other cult movements, I think we had mentioned the Black Hebrew Israelites recently, that you see very similar ideas of... they're not the same as the evangelical Christian Zionists, but there's a lot of parallels in terms of that cult movement with this idea of being LARPing. Oh, we're the real Jews. Jews aren't Jews. We're the real Jews. And it's actually a borrowed sort of oppression narrative that the book of Exodus, because it talks about slavery in Egypt, that must therefore be talking about the slavery experience of Black people in, modern post, the last few centuries or so, but it has nothing. That's not what Exodus is talking about, right? So the context is not, it's about the stories of, the Jews in Egypt and Pharaoh and all that, but that's appropriated by the cult to be them. So basically a lot of these groups are basically just trying to sort of LARP as something else is the point.
No, it is. It's fascinating. I want to talk about that. That's an interesting emerging type of thing. I've seen on the internet a lot of these movements have really reproduced themselves rapidly on social media in ways that they haven't been before. Before, you used to have to go to the street corners of New York and Detroit and Atlanta, and you might meet some of these people. But they had newsletters and stuff. Now you have huge, online organizations about this. I'm with Jay Dyer, a fantastic analyst, a philosopher, an author, a presenter. We're talking about the end times cults, Christian Zionism, Israel, the Red Heifer. We're going to delve into a little more of this on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. This is TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back after these messages.
Right now, the forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care. For life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most. To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
Hi, I'm Ryan Blaney, a third-generation race car driver, and we dedicate a lot of our time to going as fast as possible. But when my grandpa was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, it was a very unexpected bump in the road for us. It's important to notice if older family members are acting differently, experiencing problems with their memory, or having trouble with routine tasks. Early detection of Alzheimer's can give your family time to explore support services, make a plan for the future, and access available treatments. If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together.
Patrick Henningsen talks on Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, folks, to the final segment of the final hour of this live broadcast here on Monday. And in case anybody didn't notice. We are extremely close to a sort of World War III type of escalation ladder in the Middle East. Now, Iran facing off against Israel. This has awoken the Christian right, of course. Christian Zionists are now anticipating that we're getting very close to that final battle, the Armageddon, that is they've been talking about for years, for centuries, in fact, in some cases. To help us navigate some of this, I'm with Jay Dyer. He is an author, a presenter. He's also a philosopher, a real philosopher, I might add. Jay, there's a lot of people who call themselves philosophers online. And as we're on the subject, one of them is Ben Shapiro, who other people call a philosopher. That he's been called the greatest or most popular, most read or most listened to online philosopher in the world. And Jordan Peterson as well is the most popular. Most.
That's because he sticks to facts and logic. Facts and logic, Patrick. That's because he only sticks to the facts and logic, and that's it.
So, yeah, no emotions, only facts and logic. That's why. So, I couldn't resist the bench of your impression. So,
you know, on that topic, just on the political and the philosophical side of this as well, Ben Shapiro took a very hard stance defending Israel and everything they were doing after October 7th. And he's come a lot of pushback, a lot of heat he's taken as a result of that, the big split with Candace Owens and the Daily Wire and everything. And it is funny, and I thought it's interesting. This he became famous battling identity politics and SJW, social justice warriors. And it seems to me, Jay, and tell me if I'm completely out of bounds here. I'm sure some people are going to be pissed off at what I'm about to say, but he seems to be one of the greatest, biggest SJW social justice warriors and identity politics peddlers, but for Zionism or for Israeli or Jewish identity politics. He is absolutely their number one ambassador. And it seems like this is kind of an extreme version of identity politics, but one that nobody likes to talk about, but it does manifest itself in politics, of course, in culture as well. And right now it's a front and center issue with what's going on in the Middle East, in terms of the, you know, viability of the Jewish state of Israel or the whatever the Zionist state of Israel. What do you think about that? Do you think that this is a type of identity politics?
Yeah, I think that, and you know, in the way media is now online, it's very difficult to have double standards, and so people are immediately going to recognize those double standards to where if you're pushing your firm belief in free speech, and then doubling down and saying that I'm trying to remember the phraseology he used about Tucker and other people that were asking questions, and Shapiro says you're not just asking questions, you're not allowed to ask questions. Yet, wouldn't that be free speech? So whatever you believe a person's motives are for asking the questions is really irrelevant to whether it's still part of the free speech to ask those questions. So I think people are just recognizing very quickly double standards. We know the Daily Wire was very adamant when it came to stabbies that they promoted, when it came to other things that they promoted. And then later we saw people like Shapiro and Jordan Peterson sort of backing away from and kind of saying maybe they were wrong about that. I think when it was absolutely necessary to do so, I suspect that I don't have no knowledge of this. My opinion is that probably the Daily Wire doesn't allow anybody there near anybody that has, quote, conspiracy theories. Of course, we don't really know what that is. I mean, that could just be your geopolitical analysis just happens to be, quote, conspiracy theory. I mean, we've talked about the history of dispensationalism. Is that conspiracy theory or is that just geopolitics? So these are very ambiguous terms that are not really defined. And I think that those outlets that are often referred to as Con Inc. Are being called out on a lot of these double standards and hypocritical positions. And people are seeing them not really budging very much, trying to keep doubling down. But I just don't know how long that's going to work if it keeps being exposed that we've got all these double standards. So, you know, this is where we are with the internet. I mean, everything's out there. People can go dig it up. And so you either have to admit, all right, I was wrong. I changed my view. I was wrong about that. I just don't know how long that doubling down can last. And absolutely, it's another kind of identity politics that can be manipulated, which you've covered for many years. And also, I think, one of the models that he chose, which I guess works, was for many years, yeah, he was debating social justice warriors and sort of owning the libs and all, but he was really debating a bunch of, you know, purple-haired 18-year-old college students. I mean, who couldn't win a debate with an 18-year-old college student who doesn't know anything, and is sort of spouting out about, dolphins and identifying as a clopper or something. I mean, who couldn't win that debate? So it's a very low-hanging fruit model that Con Inc. relied on for so long. And I'm starting to think that, you know, we're really seeing that model kind of breaking. It's not gonna work to continue to own the libs like it's 2015, 2016 anymore, when people can see that you were pushing the stabby and the lockdowns and all this. Maybe they didn't push lockdowns, I don't know about that, but pushing the stabby at least a few years ago.
It's stabby. That's code for jibby jab. Stabby.
So I'm just so people used to, you know, YouTube makes me speak another language because of, you know, all the censorship. So I'm just used to the code words now.
I know you do have to use code words, don't you? I know you do.
Yeah.
Just to keep your videos up on that platform. It's pretty crazy. Yeah. This is that's interesting. You know, Candace Owens, to me, she's fascinating because they really worked hard to kind of cultivate her as right. this sort of, you know, conservative, really the tip of the spear, actually. They really used her out front to sort of, you know, fight off the woke, all the sort of Black Lives Matter, the crazed college students that you were talking about. And Ben Shapiro was just kind of there micromanaging all that. And all of a sudden, she's asserting her Christian identity. And she said, I think it was Christ is King. That was a controversial statement, apparently a bridge too far for some. And then you start seeing these splits, and these shouldn't be political, but yet it's hard to separate the politics and the religion because this kind of proves it, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's a lot of issues there. You know, the idea of, social teaching of Christianity in the Christian church. This is something that, for example, historically, at least, the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church have had a pretty fairly consistent idea that there are social norms that Christian peoples and Christian nations can expect and should work for in the civil sphere. So, you know, things like pro-life, and maybe if you believe in the death penalty, you might be pro-death penalty, etc. There's different positions that one could list, ethically and morally, that might be a part of that. But when it comes to the evangelical sphere, this is a little more controversial because, of course, I think Daily Wire has kind of an outreach to both sort of normie Roman Catholics out there through Walsh and Knowles, and then sort of an outreach to maybe the sort of a normie evangelical world through Ben Shapiro and some of the other ladies that are commentators there. And perhaps, as you said, I think, you know, Candace was intended to fill another role there for maybe reaching Black audiences with a conservative message. And when you get to one of these key issues that divides, for example, classic Protestant and Catholic theology or Orthodox theology, like the social kingship of Christ, and is there a sense in which Christian theology relates to the civil sphere, it's very difficult to not come to an impasse there. And I think that's partly what was going on. That does offend a lot of Christian Zionists. It offends a lot of perhaps secular-minded people in America. It offends the atheists. So it's a very hot-button contentious issue. I don't think it's intentionally anti-Semitic, so that was an odd angle on this. So everything seems to be turned into everything is an offensive, say, anti-Semitic issue. I don't think everything is. So there was a lot going on in this Christ is King Candace issue, but it forced, I think, this reckoning, I guess you could say, with, what is Con Inc. really? Is this really about, quote, conservative message, or is this another version of Fox News, basically?
Yeah, and also this, it's the cultivating the anti-Semitism charge is kind of losing its sting because it's kind of been overused, over egg. Oh, yeah. So it, but it itself is a victimology sort of framework, isn't it? So, and this is the very thing that Ben Shapiro railed against exactly. the left for constantly. And he himself is using it as his sort of, you know, magic cloak. But it just doesn't have, it doesn't have the same effect that it had before. So with this, this is just one of those big sort of tools, if you will, in sort of, you know, it's like a hand grenade you used to be able to throw into the debate and then just end it, just say anti-Semitism. Now that that's gone, now people having to have real conversations about some of this stuff. So I actually think this is a great time, Jay, where there's an opportunity for real debate now on some of these issues that were just so pinned down with all of these different guardrails. And it seems like, I don't know if you agree or not, but the conversation's getting a lot more open, a lot more honest, and people are saying things that maybe they couldn't say before. I'm not talking about the extreme racist element. And believe me, this is greenlit a lot of hardcore Nazis to come out from the shadows and reassert themselves on social media. But what are your thoughts about the current atmosphere for discourse right now?
Yeah, I like the analogy you gave there of a grenade. I mean, it used to be any topic at all, these hot button topics that you would bring up, you know, just immediately shouted down. And so no rational discourse, no reasoned discourse, no real debate. And I think a lot of people in media realize that you just, there's no point in certain topics even being discussed. And I think that we're still at that phase of maybe not with the fact of Israel being everywhere in the news, everywhere in discussion, everywhere in debate, that it's really impossible to tell everyone you can't say anything or criticize Israel in any way. And I think a lot of people, and even in Israel, are critical perhaps of the regime there. So ideally, I think what the West has shot for, at least since, well, even in the Middle Ages, even before the Enlightenment, there was a very vibrant culture of debate. You can go back to the medieval universities, which would have public debates sphere going all the time, and that would even include laity. It wasn't just the priests. There were lay professors that were debating all the time. Byzantium was known for a very vibrant debate culture. A lot of people don't know this, so it's very much a part of our tradition. And to have, you know, big tech and all of this mainstream media in the last 20, 30, 40 years, more mainstream legacy media and then big tech, you know, trying to really shut down all discourse at all, it really, I think, is more and more backfiring. And people are realizing, I think the COVID was really, the COVID was really what woke everybody up to, hey, wait a minute, like you can't even talk about this, you know, ivermectin. Right. You can't say anything. And then now we're realizing, well, now, wait a minute. If we couldn't talk about all that stuff, how come we can't talk about what's going on in terms of Israel versus Palestine? And I think that the eventually the dam just broke to where people just decided we're going to talk about it anyway. The entire world is talking about it. So it's ridiculous to try to continue to, you know, use these heavy handed measures to not let people talk about it. And that actually, I think, was an overstepping of the power structure. The power structure tried to be so heavy-handed that it ended up, I think, causing the dam to burst.
Yeah, and I remember watching this, I don't know if the 70s, you've probably seen the old clips, Jay, on PBS, and where you have these debates between these intellectuals and Michel Foucault versus you know, William F. Buckley.
What was it, Dividing Line, like the Buckley Show? Yeah.
Yeah, they used to have these programs, and they were heavily promoted. Like, people would stop, organize their evening around some of these debates. And then that kind of subsided, that culture. But I think it's coming back. I know you're also, that's a big part of what you do, is you platform debates. You're doing it on X Twitter spaces right now, and you're getting a lot of interest. You did this on YouTube for years as well. And you and some others, you guys have really, you know, your sort of group of, I don't know, maverick sort of intellectual philosophical mavericks have platformed these debates, and you've made it more trendy, I think, and more fashionable to that. This is something that people should be spending their time watching and doing for younger generations as well. So I think you've been successful, especially in the religious and philosophical fields. So I do see that trend increasing. And it's just going to get bigger and bigger. So if you had a chance to square off against somebody, who would you want to debate if you had the opportunity right now?
Oh, that's we've invited quite a few people to do debates. I've noticed with a lot of the really big name people, quite often what happens is that you kind of have to keep pressing it. It usually takes maybe 1 to 2 years. Before maybe they realize who you were, or they've heard your name enough, and then they agree to a debate. But, you know, we've asked a lot of people that were pretty big name people that turned it down. I've thrown out there that on Twitter, you know, I'd like to debate Ben Shapiro. I'd like to debate Muhammad Hijab. I'd like to debate Cosmic Skeptic, Dawkins, you know, any of those kinds of characters.
Sam Harris.
Sure. I don't think for a lot of those people, there's much incentive for them to do the debate. You know, that they have, I guess, more to lose, nothing to gain by having a debate with me, but certainly those would be, you know, people I wouldn't say no to those people for sure.
No, that's definitely something. Some of those names will probably happen at some point, Jay. So something to look forward to. Jay Dyer, really appreciate it. You've got a live show coming up. Give it a shout before we go.
Yeah, thank you. You can find me over at Jay's Analysis. You can find me on Twitter under my name, Jay Dyer. You can get my books at Jay's Analysis. My recent book is this little introduction to philosophy, a lot of essays that I've done over the years about philosophy. You can get my books at the website in the shop.
And a live event coming up? You got a?
Oh, I'm sorry. We have a lot. Yeah, June 22nd in Las Vegas with Jamie Kennedy. I will be doing a 6-hour event of lectures and comedy. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Jay Dyer in Las Vegas, folks. Get your tickets. Jay, thank you very much. Thank you to Tony Gosling in the first hour. Big thank you to our listeners, our viewers, for a fantastic program. We'll see you same time, same place tomorrow. Patrick Henningsen, your host, signing out.